Welcome to the Narrow Path Radio Program, hosted by Steve Gregg. Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be able to be taken. In the place of the usual format, we've put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of topics important to anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. In addition to the radio program, The Narrow Path has a website you can go to, www.thenarrowpath.com, where you can find hundreds of resources that can all be downloaded for free. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to Steve Gregg and The Narrow Path.
Our first caller today is Linda from Snohomish, Washington. Linda, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My son called me up the other day, and he says, Mom, he says, have you heard that saying, the lion will lay down with the lamb? And I said, well, sure. And he said, Mom, it's not right. There isn't any.
Yeah.
And so I started digging through Isaiah and all in Revelations around the Bible and, you know, in the concordance, and there isn't any. It's a wolf will lay with the lamb.
That's right.
That's the only thing I can find. Isaiah 11.
You're right. And Isaiah says it twice. He says it in Isaiah 11:8, and also in Isaiah 65. He says,
the wolf
also shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf with the young lion, and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them.
Where did that all come from? I've heard that my whole life. And I never even thought to look it up, you know.
Did you say it was your son who brought it up?
Right.
It's possible that he's listening to some internet chatter that suggests that there's some kind of mysterious, sinister, supernatural change.
No, he didn't hear it on the internet. He was talking to a friend of his.
All right. Well,
talking about different things. Okay, in the Bible.
But people are bringing this. People are bringing this point up very frequently on the internet, and either he or his friend or someone else may have done so because there is a conspiracy theory out there that there's been a technological breakthrough into the powers of darkness and that there's been some strange changes being made to the King James Version of the Bible. And one of the examples they bring up is that the King James Version used to say the lion will lay down with the lamb, but if you turn to the passages now, it doesn't say that. It says the lion and the wolf, shall dwell together. And so they're saying, you see, there's this demonic power supernaturally changing the text.
Said something about the particle generator that CERN.
That's what it's talking about. That's what it's about, yeah. So he has heard it from the internet.
I've heard that, I'm 64 years old, and I said, I've heard that my whole life.
Well, the truth is, the Bible never said the lion will lay down with the lamb. People think they remember that because that's the picture they've seen on the Christmas cards. The Christmas cards always have a lion and a lamb lying down together. It's a great image. And it's based on this passage, but it's not really strictly, what the passage says. The passage talks about the lion lying down with the young calf and the lamb and the kid lying down with the wolf and the leopard. The idea is, of course, that the hostility between the domestic and the predatory creatures is reversed or ended. And so the image of a lion and a lamb lying down together has graced many Christmas cards and many Christmas images. I'm not sure why Christmas, since it's not, the imagery in Isaiah is not about the birth of Jesus, but it still is a popular thing in our culture. So all of us have been raised with the idea of a lion and a lamb lying down together. But those of us who've read the Bible all our lives realize that it never said that. So there are attempts being made to suggest that, the Bible has mysteriously changed. What they're actually suggesting is that the King James Version that you have sitting on your shelf that's been there for 50 years used to say something, but now the words in it have mysteriously and supernaturally changed. As if the demons have a particular interest in changing the King James Version of the Bible, which is not the one most people read anymore anyway, or as if that particular change would be somehow promoting some satanic agenda, which I can't imagine that it would. It's what we have here is people playing with other people's minds. Now, there are people saying, you always heard the lion and the lamb will lie down. Well, look it up. It's not there. It doesn't say that. You see, it's changed. No, it hasn't changed. It's simply flawed memories or people who never looked it up in the first place but thought they had seen it there because they've seen the imagery so much in their minds. So, there's been no change in the text, and the text never did say a lion will lie down with the lamb, nor did the Hebrew text. or the Septuagint. So, and those haven't changed either. So this is just something that some conspiracy theorists are out there. They're playing with people's brains a little bit, and they either don't know what they're talking about, or they do, and they're just trying to be deceptive. And
right, that's what
obviously
I told
your son heard
and
from
I
them.
Said, you know, even if that was the case, what could you do about it? So I said, don't worry about it, you know. I just started laughing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, too. You know, when people say, well, there's this demonic deception unleashed on the world. Well, what am I supposed to do about it differently than what I'd normally do? What am I normally
exactly
supposed
what I
to
told
do?
Him.
I'm supposed to hold to the truth. I'm supposed to preach the truth. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to spread light in darkness. And my duty would be no different if there was a particle generator bringing demons out to change the King James Bible in a few passages. You know,
you
I mean,
know,
so
Lion
what?
And Lamb doesn't change the gospel anyway, so.
Doesn't change anything. Yeah.
No.
All right. Anyway, yeah, anything. Just tell
right,
your son that tell your son that it never changed.
Yeah, I did. I told him not to worry about it. So.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
God bless you, Linda. Okay, our next caller is Mike from Hillsboro, Oregon. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
Good.
I got two scriptures, okay?
Uh-huh.
One of them is, fear not he who can kill the body, but fear him who can kill the body and cast the soul into hell. That's number one. And number two is, they will be cast into outer darkness where there will be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Now, just precisely, okay, what are we talking about here?
In the second verse or the first one?
Well, both of them, really.
Well, when Jesus talked about fearing him who can destroy the body and the soul in Gehenna, Jesus was talking about Gehenna. Now, the English translations almost always translate that as hell, which is unfortunate, because they also translate some other Greek words as hell. They translate the word Hades as hell, which is not the same thing as Gehenna. And they translate the word Tartarus in 2 Peter chapter 2. Also, they translate that as hell, which is not the same word either. Tartarus, Hades, Gehenna, they're not all synonyms, but there's some confusion in the fact that the translators use the same English word, the word hell, to translate all of them. And it would have been certainly more of a service to the readers if the translators had said, you know, instead of making up an English word to cover all the bases of these three Greek words, maybe we should just give the Greek words as they stand. That's what they did with the word baptize. They didn't translate baptizo. They just transliterated baptize. The translation would have been immersed. They didn't
okay.
translate it. And so some modern translations, for example, the New King James and many others, they don't translate the word Hades as hell anymore. They just leave it untranslated. They say Hades. So, but Gehenna, they still do translate as hell. And the reason they do is because they feel that the fires of Gehenna, which Jesus spoke about, must be a reference to the lake of fire, which is read about in Revelation 20, when you read about those who are not found written in the book of life or cast into the lake of fire. So I think most Christians assume that Gehenna is the same as the lake of fire, and that would be more properly translated as hell. And that is why so many translations translate Gehenna as hell. Now, they feel most Christians think that way, but I don't think that's necessarily correct. It might be, but there's certainly another suggestion that makes as much, if not more, sense. And that is that they could have, in fact, translated Gehenna, but not as hell, because the word Gehenna doesn't mean hell. In Greek, the word Gehenna has an actual meaning. It literally means the Valley of Hinnom. Gehenna is a Greek word that means Valley of Hinnom. And so if they had translated it correctly, instead of using the word hell, they would have used the word Valley of Hinnom. Now, they didn't do that because the translators believe that Jesus was talking about hell in these passages. And so they wanted their readers also to believe that Jesus was talking about hell. And if they had translated the word Gehenna properly, if they translated it as Valley of Hinnom, it would certainly give a different impression than hell. And so in order to support the idea that Jesus was talking about hell, our English translators almost all translate Gehenna as hell. Now, I think it'd be nice if the translators actually translated from Greek into English when they're making an English translation, in which case almost all the times that you find the word hell in Jesus' teaching, it would be translated instead the Valley of Hinnom. It's better to be you know, have an eye plucked out or hand cut off than to be thrown into the valley of Hinnom.
Okay? Yeah, I'm familiar with that. How about the outer darkness and weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth?
Well, that could be a reference to the lake of fire also, and many people think it is. And I'm not going to dispute that it is. I think in some cases, the weeping and gnashing of teeth in Jesus' teaching does correspond with the lake of fire, with hell. And therefore, although Jesus doesn't use the word hell, he does speak about being in outer darkness. So traditionally, Christians think of that as a reference also to hell. And I'm not against that suggestion. Obviously, it's not something I'm totally committed to, for the simple reason that it's not obvious. It's not obvious that outer darkness means a lake of fire. Fire, for example, doesn't convey the idea of darkness. But it could be. It could be that the lake of fire and outer darkness are both symbolic terms, neither of them literal, and they both speak of the final judgment in, the lake of fire.
Okay, that leaves me with this, much confusion of it as I've started with, although I do believe that there is some kind of punishment for sin. No doubt in my mind there is.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't understand.
Well, yeah.
There wouldn't be. That's what I... If God is determined to have perfect justice, if we get perfect justice and we come to the Lord and our sins are forgiven and all of that business, which I believe, then why wouldn't there be perfect justice for the people that totally reject with their own will to go with God? What is he going to do with them?
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, well, I think you're right. I think every evangelical believes you're right. I'm an evangelical, and I believe you're right, that there certainly must be perfect justice in the punishment of sinners.
Well, anyway, that's the only question I had for you, and I do appreciate your program, okay? I want you to have a wonderful day.
Okay, I appreciate your call also. God bless you. Let's talk to Stephen from Ohio. Stephen, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. This is a follow-up question to some statements you made last week on the Constitution. I have a statement to make and then a question. Back in Abraham Lincoln's day, even, there was a movement called the Christian Amendment Movement, and it was an attempt to get, God and Jesus and Christ into the Constitution. And there were several, through the years, attempts, even as recently as 1954, there was an attempt to put Jesus and Christ and, mention God as the supreme ruler and lawgiver in the Constitution. And even though they said that, if it interfered with the Constitution in any way, as far as the organization of an official church or anything like that, to let them know, and they would even, revise their words. And still, the government turned all those amendments down. That's pretty sad. Do you think that that's a key to understanding this question? Is the Constitution a godly document? And then how are we Christians supposed to deal with the Constitution? Because it proclaims itself as the supreme law of the land. And yet the Holy Bible says that in Acts 5:29, we ought to obey God rather than men. So how are we supposed to deal with the Constitution?
Well, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, but every land has a supreme law. The Bible, or we should say the words of Christ, are the supreme law of the church. The church is not the same thing as the country. The country is, as you pointed out, a secular entity. Any attempts to try to make the Constitution a Christian document have been thwarted. It's a secular document. It's a pluralistic document. It's not Christian. You asked, is it a godly document? No, not particularly. I think it's a very wisely constructed document when it comes to lining out the limitations of government power and defining, the rights in many respects of the citizens in a secular country. This is a secular country. It always has been. Now, some of the people who have who you know, put it together were godly people. I don't doubt that. And I'm sure that many of them had very godly motivations in doing it. But they were very studiously avoiding making the Constitution a religious document. That's why they don't mention God or Jesus or Christ or, you know, the church or anything like that. So what we have in America, as in all countries, is a secular state. Well, I shouldn't say in all countries, because some countries have national religions, though most of them have moved in the direction of secularism. But America was probably the first nation that was ever established specifically to be secular, because all the countries in Europe before America was founded were either Protestant or Catholic, and they had state churches. That's one reason people left that that continent to come and establish something here. They didn't want there to be a state church. They didn't want to have a country that that told people what their religion should be. And so they made a secular state. But in a secular state, if it's a pluralistic state, then every religion has the right to be practiced by those who believe it. And none has the right to impose itself on others. So that's kind of how I'd like to live. I would rather live in a country where people are serving Jesus Christ, because not because the country says they have to, but because they want to. Because as soon as the country makes laws that says you have to be a Christian, well, then you're going to have the church full of people who aren't real heartfelt Christians, are not really born again. Much better to have a country where people who are Christians are Christians voluntarily, because they really believe it, because they really want to live it, because they really love God. So as difficult it is as it is to be in a secular country, because we who are Christians believe that everyone should see things, you know, in a godly way, nonetheless, as soon as the government establishes some state religion, then everybody has to toe the line of that religion. And we might think, well, that'd be good if the state religion was Christian. But the question then would be, which version of Christian? Should they be Presbyterian? Should they be Methodist? Should they be Pentecostal or Baptist or Catholic or Episcopalian or Congregational or Nazarene or Salvation Army? Which version of Christianity, Plymouth Brethren, which version of Christianity would prevail? And whichever one did, that's what everyone would have to go along with. And I got a feeling that if the government was officially Baptist, that the Presbyterians and the Catholics and the Methodists would have some objections to that. But it wouldn't help. They wouldn't have the freedom to be Methodists or Catholics or Presbyterians. They'd have to be Baptists. Is that really a good thing? Well, if you're a Baptist, it sounds like a good thing. But suppose you're a Baptist and the prevailing government is instead Episcopalian or Pentecostal, then you wouldn't think it's so good. You see, if there's going to be a state religion, that means the state decides what you're going to believe. And Christians have enjoyed for many centuries in this country the freedom to believe what their conscience tells them to believe, what they think the Bible means. And that would change as soon as we write into the Constitution certain doctrines that everyone's supposed to believe. So the Constitution is not a godly document. It's a secular document. But if it is followed properly, it preserves the right of godly people to be godly without government interference. And that's a good thing. And in that respect, America is very different than other governments. You know, the longstanding countries of Europe, if you look at their ancient charters under which they were founded, they all mention Jesus Christ. They all mention Jesus Christ as King and Lord in the European nations. They don't follow them anymore, but that's how those countries were founded, because they were either Roman Catholic or they were Protestant, but all countries of Western Europe were once officially Christian. But look how much good that did. Their charters say that, but there's hardly any evangelical Christians in Europe. I mean, it's a very tiny minority. So, Europe's about more secular than we are, even though their government charters are more Christian than ours. So rather than having Christianity mandated by government charter or constitution, it's much better to have Christianity rise in an open and free marketplace of ideas where it can press its claims and truth claims against the truth claims of other philosophies and religions. Because Christianity always does well in that kind of a competition because, of course, Christianity's truth claims are true because it is the truth. So it never has anything to, fear from a competition, open and free competition in the marketplace of ideas.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Stephen, thank you for your call. Brittany from Las Vegas, Nevada is next. Brittany, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks
for calling.
Hi, how are
you?
Hi.
I'm Brittany from Las Vegas. I have a question. I recently came across an article and read into a little bit of the sources regarding Nimrod, the character, I can't call him character, but the person known as Nimrod in Genesis, I want to say it's Genesis 10, which led to the Babylonian kingdom,
right,
and among other Cush and all of those things. Nimrod is listed as Noah's grandson or great-grandson, I can't remember. But some things that were proposed to me was that Nimrod in our, whether it be the New King James Version or the King James or whatever, because I've looked through Bible Gateway, a lot of our American translations say that Nimrod was a great hunter and he was mighty before the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
But a friend of mine is an Orthodox Jew.
Uh-huh.
And when he looked into, I suppose Josephus is one of the historians or something of that time,
mm-hmm,
and he indicated that Nimrod was actually a wicked man.
Uh-huh.
That him being mighty before the Lord is another interpretation would be like if you're standing face to face with someone and you're trying to argue with him or fight with him or whatever, you're against each other.
Yeah.
And it was not a good thing before God. And I just wanted to know if you've done any studies on this this person or this kingdom that supposedly propelled Babylon, the anger that he had against God for the flood and everything, and he decided, or at least what they're saying, he decided or perpetuated the building of the Tower of Babel because he was so angry against God, or he turned people away from God. Have you done any study on this?
Well, I've studied Nimrod before. Yeah, I don't know very much about his motivations. Nimrod is the founder of the Tower of Babel, and therefore of the Babylonian society, which later became a Babylonian empire, much later. When it says he's a mighty hunter before the Lord, there are people who translate it that he was a mighty hunter against the Lord. So that seems to support one of the things you were saying. There's very little said about him in the Bible, and it's hard to know who to associate with him within secular history, but there are mentions of persons in, secular records from the ancient times that are often thought to refer to Nimrod. Some think that Gilgamesh may have been Nimrod. Gilgamesh epic. And there are other theories. I mean, many people believe he was the son of, that his son was Tammuz. And so forth.
Isn't that related? That's related to like the creation of the sun, the pagan worship of sun,
Something like that. Yeah, years ago, a few generations ago, a guy named Alexander Hislop wrote a large volume called The Two Babylons, and he had a lot of information about Nimrod in there, which many people have questioned. In fact, I think some people have said that it's been, in the years since that was written, that a lot of it has been debunked. I have not studied it intensively, only because it's not one of my most compelling interests. But my assumption has always been, like your own, from what we are told, that he is the founder of the Tower of Babel. And the Tower of Babel was built in rebellion against God. So we know he was in rebellion against God. We don't know why. We don't know if he was angry about the flood, like I think you suggested, or if he was just ambitious and wanted everyone to follow him. Lots of men have had that in them. So we aren't told much about his motivations.
Okay. I think that's it.
Okay, Brittany. So I don't know much more about him, but there's a lot of secular, a lot of people have linked him with certain secular, records about things, but it's as far as whether he's the same guy or not is perhaps something that not everyone would agree about.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling me. I only have about a minute before we're going to have to take a break at the bottom of the hour. We have some of our stations leave the network at the half-hour point. The program goes on for an hour. That is another half hour. And if you are listening to a station that actually leaves the network at this point, you can hear the second half of the program by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where we stream the program live and we archive it for later. There's also a podcast, and there's also our internet, our telephone apps, which you can listen to the program all the way through on those apps. And they are free, so you might want to check those out. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and we pay for the radio time. We buy the time on the radio. There's no one paid at The Narrow Path. I'm a volunteer. Everyone's a volunteer. We got a lot of people who volunteer, but nobody gets paid a penny, and no one receives any benefits. But we do take the money that is given, and we give it to radio stations so that we can stay on the air, and that's what we do. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you want to from our website, thenarrowpath.com. But thenarrowpath.com is a resource for you to take things for free. Everything is free there. Or you can donate at thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned. In about 30 seconds, we will be right back to continue the program for the second half hour.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be taken. In place of the usual format, we have put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of topics important to anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to The Narrow Path.
And let's talk to Gene from Anaheim, California. Gene, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about the pre-trib rapture view. I know you've said several times that that's something like John Darby in 1820 basically came up with. And I've talked to some friends that gave me some documents. They said, Gene, look, this guy, these people believe this way back. And he gave me a list of all these names. I just was curious as to, you know, the foundation there and if that's accurate or not. I just want to get your take on it.
Well, Darby, by the way, was in the 1830s. But give me the names of the people you're talking about. Are you thinking of Pseudo-Ephraim?
Let's see. Irenaeus in Against Heresies. He just has a list of names.
Irenaeus did not believe in the pre-trib rapture. But go ahead.
Okay. Hippolytus.
Yeah, these are not references to people who believe in the pre-trib rapture. Those are references to people who are premillennial.
Okay.
Those church fathers were premillennial, but they were not pre-trib.
So okay, talk to me a little bit about that.
Okay. Premillennialism is a question of when the millennium occurs, or more properly, mm-hmm. when the second coming of Christ comes with reference to the millennium. The millennium, of course, is a thousand-year reign mentioned in Revelation 20. And premillennialists believe that Jesus' return will be before the millennium. So they call it premillennial coming of Christ. There are people who are postmillennial who believe that Jesus comes back at the end of the millennium. And there are amillennialists, like myself, who believe that the millennium is symbolic for the age of the church. Now, these are different views about the millennium. They are not different views about the rapture. Now, there have been premillennialists from the earliest days of the church. Irenaeus, Hippolytus, Papias,
Justin Martyr.
Yeah, these men were all premillennial. They also had people in the early church who were not premillennial. Unfortunately, we don't have their writings, but we have reference to them. Justin Martyr, who you just mentioned, was premillennial, but he mentions that many Christians of his day were not. And so there were different views on the millennium in the early days. Beginning around Augustine's time, the premillennial view pretty much died out and was not really found in the mainstream church until the 19th century. And it was revitalized by its reintroduction by John Nelson Darby. Now, Darby was premillennial, but more than that, he was what we'd call dispensational.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be premillennial only means that you believe Jesus will come back before the millennium. And like I said, there were many church fathers who believed that, and some who did not. But the question is, with reference to the rapture, now the church fathers who believed in premillennialism did not believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. They did not believe in dispensationalism. Dispensationalism was the invention of John Nelson Darby, and he was the one who integrated into his theology the idea that there will be a seven-year tribulation, and before that tribulation will come a rapture of the church. Now, Darby's not the absolute earliest person to make reference to a pre-tribulation rapture, but he is the one who integrated it into a theological system. In the late 18th century, there was a Baptist minister who's on record as apparently believing in a rapture 3.5 years before, or at least some short time before the second coming of Christ. So that'd be like one of the very first we know of. There was a writing by someone named Pseudo-Ephraim. His name wasn't Pseudo-Ephraim. If he was really Ephraim, he was Ephraim, but the scholars think the document is Pseudo, not really Ephraim of Syria. But he wrote a very long and ambiguous statement, which some people believe teach a pre-trib rapture. But if he did, he was really out of step with all the others of his time, because the other church fathers throughout history taught that the rapture will take place at the second coming of Christ, not prior to it. So among people who are premillennial, there are those who are dispensational premillennialists, and they are the ones who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. And there are those who are premillennialists, but they're not dispensational. We call those historic premillennialists. Historic premillennialists believe in a future millennium after the second coming of Christ, but they don't believe in a pre-trib rapture or other distinctives of dispensationalism.
So what would they say that happens at the second coming, the premillennialists?
The historic premillennialists?
Correct.
They would say that when Jesus comes back, he'll raise the dead and rapture the church and establish a millennial kingdom on earth.
Okay.
You see, the dispensationalist breaks up the resurrection into two. The dispensationalist says there's a resurrection of the righteous along with the rapture before the tribulation, but that the resurrection of the wicked awaits the end of the millennium. So there would be essentially 1,007 years between the resurrection of the righteous and the resurrection of the wicked in the dispensational system. This is not something that was held by historic premillennialists.
Now, if we could jump over to all millennialists, what's the all millennialist, your view? Where are we at right now?
Well, the all millennialist does not speculate usually about where we are at right now, because the all millennialist is not looking for signs of the times. With the exception of Harold Camping, the late Harold Camping was all millennial. He was rather an embarrassing supporter of the viewpoint. Most Christians throughout history have been all millennial. But Harold Camping was one of those unusual amillennialists who, you know, set dates and so forth. And there are other amillennialists who have done so. But it's very uncommon. Amillennialists are not focused on the end times. They're focused on the kingdom of God. They're focused on spreading the word of God and spreading the kingdom of God. And they believe that there will come a time when Jesus returns, raises the dead, raptures the church, and creates a new heavens and new earth. There's not much in the amillennial system to give any clues as to how near we may be to the end.
Well, that's fine. I'm not looking at like dates, but that's something the amillennialist is looking toward, is that's still to come. That's still out there.
Yes, the second coming is still, you know, that's the blessed hope.
Right.
All right. Hey, I've got my lines full, and I got a very short radio program.
Thank you very much.
Solve your questions? Okay. God bless you. Good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Jay from Seattle, also from the same region. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Hey, yeah, I'm really excited that you're going to be around. I'm looking really forward to coming up and seeing you. That's going to be great.
Great.
So I had a question about the Psalms. You know, I've always loved the Psalms because they really bring a lot of comfort to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when there's, you know, you're in a time of uncertainty. You know, there's just been a lot of times when they've ministered to me, and I've really loved it. But I've had a little bit of a difficulty recently that I'm hoping you can help me with. You know, there's just a lot of places in the Psalms where it talks about how when we trust in God and we look to Him, He's honored by that, and he promises that He will preserve us. He will help us, and that's why I guess it's so comforting. One of my favorite places is in Psalm, you know, is Psalm 91,
yeah.
like verse 4, where it says, "He will cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and rampart." You know, and in verse 9 it says, "If you say the Lord is my refuge, and you make the Most High your dwelling, no harm will overtake you, no disaster will come near your tent." Let's see. And then verse 14, "Because He loves me, says the Lord, I will rescue Him. I will protect Him, for He acknowledges my name." Okay, that's really very comforting.
Uh-huh.
Now, my difficulty is this. You know, I'm sure that Christians around the world have looked to the Psalms for their comfort and for, you know, the same things that I've looked at. But, you know, there have been Christians that have been killed. And it really bothers me because I think, well, surely they were looking to these scriptures and acknowledging that God was going to save them or
mm-hmm.
take care of them
right.
because they
of
acknowledged
course.
Him. But what, you know,
so why are there these
mean?
Promises that don't seem to come true? Well, let
yeah.
me ask you this. Do you think the psalmists were unaware of the fact that the righteous sometimes have horrible things happen to them and sometimes suffer and die?
No, I acknowledge that. I
right.
believe
David,
that.
David when that. He was completely innocent, was, of course, pursued by Saul and rejected and had to live in, you know, for fear of his life for an extended period of time. Certainly, you know, people in the days of the Psalms, including the writers of the Psalms, lived at a time when righteous people could be seen to die young, to die terribly, to be victimized by, you know, oppressors and criminals and so forth, just as much as we can
yeah.
see it in our time today. So when they record these promises, we have to factor in the fact that they knew as much as we do about reality, and that what they seem to be saying doesn't seem to accord with all the reality, even of their own time. So why were they saying these things? Or we should say, how are we supposed to understand these things?
Yeah.
Right. I think we have to take them case by case, in a sense. Psalm 91, which you mentioned, is probably a psalm of Moses. Psalm 90 is said to be a prayer of Moses, and Psalm 91 doesn't have a title, but many scholars think that both psalms go together and were psalms mm-hmm. that Moses wrote. And when he talks about things like, you know, no plague shall come near your dwelling because you belong to the Lord and you're hidden under the Lord's wing and so forth, he could be speaking to Israel in terms of, you know, when the plagues came on Egypt, that mm. you know, the plagues came on the Egyptians, but not on the Jews. He says, 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. We know that during the plagues of Egypt, you know, the Egyptians in close proximity with the Jews were smitten by plagues which the Jews were spared from. So, I mean, there could be that, there could be in this particular psalm a reflection on the reality of the Exodus, which was a time when God came supernaturally to the rescue of the oppressed Jews who were His people and, you know, attacked only their enemies and so forth. There can be psalms that are related to specific interventions of God, and I think this might be one of them, and where it would be a mistake to try to extrapolate it out to every situation. Nonetheless, there are quite a few psalms that sound like they are just generically promising that, you know, no harm will befall the righteous, and the wicked will be brought down into humility and death and so forth. And I think we could almost say this sounds like wishful thinking on the part of the psalmist, but since we believe the psalms are inspired, I think what we could say is that these psalms are not speaking absolutely, but they are speaking of the fact that this often is the case. And the fact that it often is the case means that it could always be the case unless God makes an exception. That is to say, this is very similar to what Job's counselors felt. You know, when you read what Job's counselors felt, they were the wise men of their day. They said, you know, nothing, no harm is going to befall a righteous man. It's only the wicked that really come under disasters. But we know that Job was clearly an exception. And I'm sure the psalmist knew about Job's case, too, and Joseph's. Joseph was a righteous man who had everything bad happen to him. And these were not unknown to the psalmist. So we have to assume that while we might tend to read these things as absolute ironclad promises, such as you know, someone might warranty if they're you know, making a contract with you, that these are more generic statements of this is the kind of thing God has often done, will generally do, though God certainly reserves the right to make exceptions when he has a good reason. And that's okay. That's how I would tend to look at promises like these. There are exceptions. And sometimes the exceptions almost outnumber those that conform to the rule, although those exceptions, I think, are even those times are exceptional. Like, you know, times when the whole church is being persecuted. Well, those are usually seasons that come for a while and go. And I would have to say those are exceptions to the general rule. In general, God does treat the righteous a certain way and the wicked another way, but there are exceptions. Sometimes he lets the wicked get away with stuff for a while, and then he makes an example of them later. Or sometimes he lets a Christian suffer unjustly for a while, or even die. And we do have to remember that God sees things in the eternal perspective, and so and they can be suggesting that, you know, it's going to go well for the righteous in the end, you know. Solomon talked that way too in Ecclesiastes, and it's an interesting passage in Ecclesiastes 8. It says in Ecclesiastes 8:11, it says, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil, though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged. Yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are but a shadow, because he does not fear before God. Now, what's interesting here, he says what we typically read in the Psalms and even in the Proverbs, that it will not be well with the wicked. It's going to go badly for the wicked. But he says this is true even if the wicked person sins 100 times and gets away with it. So he's realistic. He says ultimately the wicked is going to, it's not going to be, he's not going to be enviable. You know, in the end, the wicked will be an object of derision or even pity. But he may do wickedness 100 times before that ever happens. And he's saying the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. Sometimes the vindication of the righteous is not speedy either. Remember the souls under the altar in Revelation chapter 6 that John saw, and they were saying, how long, O Lord, before you judge and vindicate us, you know, that avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And it hadn't happened, even though they were already in heaven. And so, in other words, these psalms, if we would take them in an absolute sense, and maybe there's some of them that can be taken in an absolute sense, we have to say, well, it may not apply to the outcomes in this life. It may be in the next life. The very same authors who make these statements are sometimes very much persecuted when they themselves are righteous. Or like Solomon saying, I've seen sinners sin 100 times and seem to do it with impunity, but I'm convinced that's not be well for them in the end. So it can be that that if we factor in the ultimate end of people, you know, at the judgment seat of Christ, where they go from then, we can certainly say that it goes well for the righteous and not for the unrighteous. And there may be some There may be some hint of that in the fact that the psalmists, though they often are describing circumstances that don't even conform to their own experience, they nonetheless have faith that God is a good God, and ultimately, therefore, he'll punish evil and reward the righteous. And I think that's what's expressed in those promises.
Okay. Okay, yeah. That's good. We will, you know, if we're following God and we're walking in his ways, then, you know, yeah, that's good, because it doesn't bode well for the evil one, and it will in the end for the righteous, no matter what happens. And I guess, you know, one thing that I've been really pondering, because I guess I came upon this as I was pondering, you know, my issue here with the Psalms, you know, why do they die? You know, why do people who are trusting God die? You know,
they die because everybody dies.
Well, I think about the fact that, you know, that even though they die, they go to be with the Lord. They go to a better place. To die is to gain. You know, they're going to.
Of course,
it's not like it's over. It's not like it's the end for them.
Yeah, that's basic. That's basic to the Christian mentality. Is that
yeah.
everybody dies. Some earlier, some later, but everyone ultimately dies. The real issue,
right,
where justice is going to be seen, is not in who dies when, because that's not the end of the story. That's just the transition to the next phase of the story. And at the end, there's a judgment where all things are administered justly. And certainly, the Bible says again and again, God will justly judge the world. He'll give to each one according to his works. That doesn't always happen in this life, of course, but it shall in the ultimate reckoning of things. Anyway, Jay, my lines are full. I have to move along.
Yeah. Okay,
appreciate
great.
Your call.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for calling. All right. Our next caller is John from Huntington Beach, California. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question of, we begin our time from the birth of Christ, you know, our years. And I read the other day that Herod died 4 B.C. So I wondered, Christ had been born 5 or 6 B.C. Is that right?
That's right.
And the reason for the B.C. and A.D. is that the census is taken every 6 years?
Well, no, that's not the reason necessarily. The problem here is back many, many centuries ago, somebody decided to start numbering the years on the calendar from the birth of Christ, but they didn't know exactly what year he was born. They had an opinion about when he was born, and so they used that, and then they measured all the years B.C. and A.D. from that date that they had selected. But they didn't have all the information they needed to really select the right date. So we know now that Herod died in 4 B.C., which is obviously 4 B.C. should mean 4 years before Christ was born. However, Herod was alive when Christ was born. He's the one who killed all the infants in Bethlehem trying to kill the baby Jesus. So Jesus must have been born before the death, well, was certainly born before the death of Herod, and therefore before the year that has traditionally been called 4 B.C. But, you know, we could readjust all the years, but I don't know that there'd be much motivation to do so. I don't think that most secular nations want to change all the years on their calendars and their newspapers and all their archives and everything like that, just because we now know that Herod died 4 B.C. and therefore Jesus was born a little earlier than we thought. So we stick with the traditional dating, even though anyone who's biblically literate knows that the dating is not quite accurate.
Do we know who's in authority when they set that date?
I don't remember. I've heard before. I've heard who it was that changed it, but I don't remember. It wasn't done by an emperor or anything like that, or a pope. It was done by some scholar. I forget who did it, but it was and when. But it was many, many centuries ago. And you know, we know more about history now than they knew then, and we've been able to fine tune and select that date a little more carefully.
Okay, that's very good.
All right.
Can I ask you another thing?
Uh-huh.
What about Elizabeth, Zechariah's wife, at an old age having a child, and Mary coming to her, and she was her relative. But what relative was she?
We don't know. We just know she was a relative.
Oh, that's what I thought. Okay.
A cousin of some sort. Now, Mary was of the tribe of Judah, And Elizabeth was of the tribe of Levi. She was of the daughters of Aaron, we're told, and therefore descended from the Levitical priesthood. So there was some apparently cross marriage between the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Levi in their background. But it wouldn't have been in that generation. It would have been some former generation. Could have been generations earlier, but they were somehow related. Probably not very many generations earlier did they cross, or else their relationship would be very distant. But somehow, we don't know. We don't have all the details. They were some kind of cousins.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. I appreciate your call, John.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye now.
James from Littleton, Colorado. You're next. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Could you, what do you think of the Church of Christ denomination?
Well, not everyone in the Church of Christ is exactly alike. I'm not really in favor of denominations, but the Church of Christ holds some of the same doctrines that I would hold, and it holds a few slightly different than what I would hold. So I'm not exactly, I wouldn't necessarily fit perfectly in the Church of Christ, but I appreciate that they do teach some things that I think are quite true, but that would be true virtually of every denomination. Of course, the Church of Christ would say they're not a denomination. That would be one of the things that they would affirm, that we're not a denomination. But to my mind, as I consider the word denomination and what it usually refers to, it seems to me like they have most of the features of a denomination. They have distinctive beliefs that stand out differently from other groups, and that seems to be what makes a denomination. So even the word denomination would be controversial with reference to them. I would say that the Church of Christ is in some respects like any other denomination in that it has people in it who are true followers of Jesus, and it probably has people in it who only think they are followers of Jesus and are only religious. I don't know of any denomination of which that would not be the case. It seems to me that all denominations have some true saints who are real followers, real disciples of Jesus, and some who only think they are, maybe because they grew up in the church or they've jumped through some hoops that did not involve a change in their heart, although they don't know that. And that is, they think that they've done everything that anyone else has done to become a Christian, but they don't have the experience of regeneration that some have. And, of course, they may not realize that they don't have that. I have met some people in the Church of Christ who are just the sweetest Christians you'll ever meet, and who I have no doubt that they are as good a Christian as I am, if not better. But I've also met people who were in some Church of Christ denominations that were very harsh and judgmental and didn't seem to have the Spirit of Christ at all, seemed to have more of a Pharisaic spirit. Now, that's not a criticism of the Church of Christ. That is simply a criticism of churches in general. Every church has its own character based on the quality of the Christians in it. But if you're wondering whether I think Church of Christ is a cult or something like that, I do not. I think the Church of Christ is as good a denomination as most, and maybe better than many. So I certainly wouldn't criticize them. I have some areas where I differ a bit with them. Some of the churches of Christ think it's wrong to have musical instruments, but not all do. There's instrumental Church of Christ and non-instrumental Church of Christ. I would not agree with the non-instrumental view, but then it's not a view to fight about. I could still go to their church. A cappella singing is a wonderful thing too. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and the music tells me I'm going to be cut off here in less than 45 seconds, so I'm going to have to wind down this call. But, James, I appreciate your call. I hope that may have been helpful to you. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and if you ever donate to the Narrow Path, it will help to pay the radio bills, because that's where the money goes. When money comes in, it goes out to the radio stations so that we can stay on the air. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.